This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. March Madness was a big event in Indianapolis in the midst of COVID and one of the biggest sporting events since things shut down last year. Health experts were wary of the event despite restrictions in place and the requirement for masks to be worn. So how were mask guidelines handled? That's the topic of a new study released to the Journal of the American Medical Association by researchers at the Regenstrief Institute. And with us now are Dr. Peter Emby, Regenstrief Institute President and CEO and Associate Dean for Informatics and Health Services Research at Indiana University School of Medicine, and Joshua Vest, Research Scientist at Regenstrief Institute and Professor of Health Policy at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Dr. Emby, what prompted the study of March Madness and mask wearing?
Yeah, we had been very concerned about, of course, the degree of these kinds of events causing super spreader events. And in collaboration with our colleagues here at the county and state level, we had been starting to anonymously count how well people were actually adhering to mask wearing to have a better understanding of how effective the policies have been and what impact they might be having on the spread. And so when we had the opportunity working with our colleagues to go out and count at March Madness, we thought it would be a really good and unique opportunity to see what was really happening, especially during a time when there were widespread requirements and enforcement of mask wearing that really hadn't been done. And we happened to have the people and the tools to do it. So we wanted to go out and see what was happening in the real world.
And that sort of draws me to the next question here. Joshua, as a research scientist, was this a great opportunity to get such a huge sampling of people?
Yeah, this was a phenomenal opportunity because of, one, the unique circumstances in which the NCAA tournament was held this year, with all these games being in Indianapolis. The opportunity to kind of be thoughtful and go out and look on how people behave in public health preventative measures on such a large scale doesn't come across all that often. And so this was a really great opportunity. And as Peter said, we have phenomenal cooperation from the folks here in the city, county, and at the stadium to really go out and do this very well.
Well, Peter, what were your thoughts going into it? Did you think there would be a high rate of people masking properly?
You know, maybe I'm an eternal optimist, but I really kind of did, because, you know, we knew that this was still a very big issue then. It certainly is again now and had been. We knew that a lot of people were concerned with all the folks coming into town, and that the NCAA and the stadium and everybody were taking this very, very seriously, as were all of our officials. And I was, you know, initially pleased to see, as our study showed, that at entrances and the like, people were being pretty good and pretty adherent. But that certainly was a different story when we got inside and in certain other areas. And it really is why you have to study these things to really understand what's happening.
Is part of this study just about human behavior in general, Joshua?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's there is a human behavior component. As Peter said, we had been studying what's been going on countywide for several months at this time. And we're sitting in the context of, if you put your mind back, the mask mandate, both at the state level and the city level, were still in place at the time. The stadium had done quite a bit of social messaging and activity. And this is that concept of how will people react, knowing you know, what the expectations are, but also too, in something that's very different in a very big, large social environment. There's been lots of studies of masks in just general day-to-day wearing, like people at the grocery store or going out shopping or other locations. This is a very different type of event with just a large group of people that was, you know, pretty exciting and a lot of enthusiasm and excitement around it, as you can imagine.
Did you expect what you found? Did it match your sort of hypothesis going in?
Yes, to an extent. As we said, we've been out there in the county, so we kind of had an idea of what kind of the background level was. And as Peter said, places where there was very strong enforcement, and when we say like enforcement, we're talking about things like social messaging, signs being really visible, reminders on the floor, staff present to, you know, kind of get people, staff or ushers to kind of get people gentle reminders. That was much more common, you know, in the concession areas. It was much more common at the entrances, and that's where you saw the highest levels. It, of course, occurred out in the stands as well, But then with the stands, you have to mix in the things of the excitement, people, you know, taking their masks off to eat or have a drink, to actually, as we saw as well, to really make sure their voices were heard as they were yelling for their team. That kind of changes the dynamic a bit. And we saw how people reacted with that less enforcement as well.
Well, Peter, I have to ask, what is it that's difficult about wearing a mask properly? We're talking about people, I guess, in your study wearing masks, but what about properly, like over the full mouth and nose? I know that, you know, obviously there are people who have health issues that prevent them from wearing it sometimes. But in general, what is so hard about having this worn properly, this piece of cloth?
Yeah, you know, I can understand that it's certainly for people who aren't used to wearing masks all the time, it can be somewhat uncomfortable. If you happen to, you know, be wearing glasses, they can fog up. And some people can feel a sense of, you know, being suffocated or what have you. But for the most part, people tolerate mask wearing, you know, extremely well. I think one of the biggest issues is just the sort of knowledge of how important it is to wear it properly, which is to say, you know, covering your nose and your mouth completely. Because of the whole goal of making sure that you're not expressing the virus out into the world and having it spread. And I think, you know, it's really just a matter of people realizing that, A, and then B, getting used to doing that. You know, those of us who, depending on our, you know, profession, I'm a physician, so there have been times when I have to wear a mask all day long, given whatever I happen to be doing, and you get used to that sort of thing. And I think during the pandemic, a lot of people have. So, you know, but I think there is certainly a bit of discomfort with it, and I can understand that. Overall, it's not a very hard thing to do well, but I think some people don't necessarily realize how important it is to cover both the nose and mouth completely.
I wonder sometimes if that messaging wasn't gotten out enough to say, like, the nose is, I don't know, I mean, I'm not a doctor, but the nose is a heavy carrier of virus, from what I understand, and for some reason, people just seem to think it's the mouth.
I think there certainly can be some degree of confusion out there about this. And I think, you know, again, some of it is also a matter of comfort. You know, as Josh said, too, there are times when it's understandable that you have to pull your mask down in order to be able to take a bite of whatever you're eating or take a sip of your drink. And then I think people either forget to put it back up or conveniently sort of take their time to put it back up. And you know, that's very, it's very important to make sure that you continue to be covered. You know, this was at a time when, as Josh said, you know, we were concerned. You know, today I think it has even renewed implications because we are seeing a lot more spread with even more contagious variants. And we just know that masks can be very effective at really reducing spread across the population, reducing therefore hospitalizations and deaths. And so it's an important thing to do, and it's an important thing to do properly.
If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Joshua, when you did this study, were you able to speak with anyone on why they didn't mask up correctly, or was this more of an observational study?
Yeah, so this was an observational study. We purposely didn't engage with anyone, but there's actually quite a bit of research from other folks who have talked about why people do and don't mask. There is, as Peter alluded to, there are comfort issues that people will cite. Also, too, sadly to say, there is obviously political ideology that comes into it as well. And then there's also the issue of risk assessment, you know. As individuals, as human beings, we are really, really bad at understanding risk and evaluating risk of, you know, bad outcomes or ill effects of our choices. And that also comes into it. People who tend to kind of really underestimate their risks tend not to mask as well.
So people that they might be people that engage in riskier behavior in general, sounds like.
They can go hand in hand, yes.
Well, Peter, the study found that the majority of attendees did wear their masks properly, and that seems pretty significant because we hear mostly about people who don't. Does this suggest that overall, as a society, we are following the guidelines despite some of the headlines we see?
Well, I think you're right that it is important to note that you know, about 74% of people overall were wearing their masks properly. Now, you know, we can get more into this, but there were sort of breakdowns with different groups and the like. So that's important, but it's true. I think that is reassuring to a degree, and that the majority did. I think that the difference, though, is that at this point, we really were expecting an even higher number because we know we want to get above 80% in order to have the really beneficial effects across the population. And again, as Josh said, there were strict mandates, ongoing enforcement, you know, people being reminded, not by us who were observing, but by people who were working at the venue to continue to wear their masks. And even still, we had a lot of people not doing it. And I think, you know, the concern is that now when we don't have mandates any longer, but we have recommendations, we're already starting to see reductions out there and people not following recommendations. So if even in the face of a mandate and enforcement, we were getting to 74% and differences among where people were, if they weren't really being washed or what have you, it does raise concerns for what happens when there is not that requirement or that oversight. So I don't know that I'm as confident about what we're doing societally right now. And I think the increasing numbers might suggest that we need to do more.
If I can jump in and add a little bit to what Peter said, completely agree with him. But I think something else that one of the things we think about is, and I'm going back to your question of how you phrased it about percent not masked. We're really interested in the kind of highlighting the percent that were and reinforcing the positive behavior. As Peter said, we want it to be higher. The higher the number, the safer the number, the more consistent the number, the safer. But it does illustrate that it was the normal behavior. Mm-hmm. It was kind of what the majority were doing. It wasn't like the lone oddball kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, weirdo who was masking, right? This is what most people were doing. And so it really does help kind of reinforce that that's what our community kind of expectations are. And that should help drive people who are a little bit more reluctant than kind of thinking about it the other way around and really focusing on, you know, the large percent that didn't mask.
Yeah, that's very well said.
Right, right. Well, I want to thank you both for joining us this afternoon. Very informative discussion, and hopefully we'll have you back on again to hear more about the next iteration of this study. I'm sure there's going to be another one.
We'd love to. Thank you.
Dr. Peter Embee, Regenstrief Institute President and CEO and Associate Dean for Informatics and Health Services Research at Indiana University School of Medicine, and Joshua Vest, Research Scientist at Regenstrief Institute and Professor of Health Policy at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. If you've heard about toxic chemicals in cosmetics or about recalls on things like sunscreen, you may be wondering, what's the big deal? Should we be worried? We'll find out next after this quick break. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Potentially toxic chemicals known as PFAs or forever chemicals have been found in some cosmetics at varying levels, and the findings come from Indiana scientists who studied various types of cosmetics from concealers to mascara. And what they found was eye-opening, no pun intended. With us now to discuss the research and findings are Marta Venier, assistant professor at the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs, and Graham Peasley, professor of physics at the University of Notre Dame. Welcome to both of you. Let's start with PFAs, Professor Graham. What exactly are they?
They're a class of chemical. They're the world's best surfactant. They're manufactured around World War II, and they're in more or less everything. Anything that you want non-stick or waterproof, we put PFAS into them, PFAS. They're pur- and polyfluorinated alkyl substances. That's a mouthful, but what it means is it's a chemical that's very good at keeping water on one side and oil on the other. And that's they're used in Teflon nonstick cookware. They're used in Scotchgard on our carpets. But we also found them in cosmetics.
And you said they're called PFAS. I've been saying PFAs. I guess I've been doing this wrong.
PFAS is the word on the street now, and it was adopted in about 2012 to refer to this entire class of about 4,700 chemicals.
Wow, that's a lot of chemicals, 4,700. That's impressive. Marta, these chemicals have been used, as Graham mentioned, in things like nonstick cookware. So I'm assuming we've ingested them at some point in our life. So just a devil's advocate here, what's the danger of it being on our faces rather than ingested in our bodies?
Miriam, there's not a lot of difference in the sense that skin is just one of the exposure routes. We can get exposed to PFAS from the water we drink, the food that we eat, the pans that we use to cook from, and cosmetics is just another one of them, except that the skin is a particular on the face is particularly thin, so there could be more dermal absorption there, so they could go through the skin more easily. And also, when we wear lipsticks, and I'm wearing one right now, we can ingest PFAs and lipsticks with it.
So is there any indication on when PFAS were put into things like cosmetics? I mean, it seems like they've been around forever, and they are forever chemicals. Graham, any insight?
We can't tell exactly. We know they've been available since World War II, but they weren't put in back then. We noticed that the new paint-on lips, the liquid lips, so-called, are where we've... It's a new category. That cosmetic really didn't exist 5 years ago. And in the last 5 years, this new cosmetic's come on, and it's waterproof, and it lasts forever. And that's a good indication that they're starting to use other types of chemicals. The foundations are much older, of course, and are the waterproof mascaras. But in those categories, we found a fairly high use of fluorine and by surrogate PFAS. And so we think that it's more in the last decade or two, people have been switching to these formulations. But we don't know which ones have them. And that's the main issue we found.
And so what prompted this study, Marta, to figure out what was going on in cosmetics?
Well, I think Graham should answer this question because he's been working on cosmetics for longer. And I think answer that, Graham.
Yeah, I'll let Marta interpret the results. But what we began was the students actually drove this. I was looking in fast food wrappers, and we were looking in textiles for industrial wearing of clothing that had been treated. And the students came up and said, could we test our cosmetics? And I said, sure. It was not hard to run our test. So they went out and collected dozens of these things, and they found that several of them were fluorinated. And so then we asked all the people we knew to collect some, and we had a very clever student that went to some cosmetic brand stores and took one of everything off the shelf and took a test swatch. And that's what we tested. And it began a study that ran to over 230 compounds that were tested. That's only a small number of the cosmetics available, but we looked at ones that we thought more likely to be fluorinated, and we found almost 50% were.
Are there any particular cosmetics that have higher levels? Like, would it be like, for example, a waterproof mascara versus a lipstick?
We didn't find by brand. We looked at brands, but every brand had some, and every brand had some that weren't. But when we looked at types, yes, the waterproof or the long-lasting was sort of the tip-offs that they were likely to be. It wasn't absolute, but those are the words that those are the only words we could find on the label that suggested this chemical might be there.
Well, Marta, what are the potential outcomes of being exposed to PFAS for a long period of time, like if you're using waterproof mascara for 10 years?
So there's still a lot more to understand about the health effect of PFAS, because as you say, they are forever chemicals and they've been out there for a while, but we still have much more to know about them. But these chemicals can be processed in our bodies, can be metabolized, and generate even more toxic compounds. And these chemicals are in general toxic, and they accumulate in our bodies. So the more we ingest or drink or absorb, the more they stay in our bodies. And in general, they have toxic effects.
Well, I mean, I would say this sounds quite alarming to me. What were your thoughts with this study, Graham? Is this something to sound the alarm on?
Yeah, we were really concerned that these are getting into consumer products without being labeled. I mean, the consumer will do a great job if they say, this one has a potential toxic chemical, this one doesn't. The market forces drive these chemicals away very quickly. If they're putting them in there without a label, then the consumer can't choose. It's got taken out of your hands to choose. And the most common question I get is brand X got fluorine in it? And I can't answer that because I only tested 200 and there's 20,000 out there. I mean, it's more likely that we will look for a label from an industry that says this was made intentionally PFAS-free. And that label isn't there yet. And several companies are now starting to think about that. But it was as a result of this paper that caught their attention and the attention of regulators that said, look, we really haven't done a good job labeling these things. It was industry promised they would label it, but they neglected to put on a few things like fluorochemicals. They weren't important. And I think that's the issue we're getting into. To be clear on the labeling, then people have a personal choice. They can choose the chemical we know bioaccumulates and is persistent, not just on the wearer of the cosmetics, just for all those people with Y chromosomes out there. I think that 10% of the cosmetics goes on to the user, but a lot of it gets thrown away at the end, and it all goes to the landfill. And these chemicals are forever chemicals. They go through the landfill and into our drinking water. So they'll get you either as a personal use or also by the drinking water. It'll get into our drinking water for years to come, generations to come. And that's what we're really looking out for.
So there's just no way to escape it. It almost sounds like you're doomed either way.
Well, the industry can escape it. They can make the decision not to use these chemicals. And there are clearly, the good news of our study is that there are clearly half the products didn't need it. So it isn't an essential chemical. It just happens to be one that works well for waterproof. If you had to have one which was a little less waterproof, would that still be acceptable? I think we'll live with that if we had healthier water to drink.
Right. Well, if you have questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Marta, I have to say, hearing that some of these waterproof lipsticks are potentially toxic gives me pause, because I just bought one the other day. I was like, oh, this is a new interesting thing. You could just put it on and leave it for a while. And now I feel like that's a very scary thing to do.
I am in a way I am in the same boat as you, except I know even more that there can be potentially toxic chemicals in the cosmetics that I buy. Now, the thing is that we don't know which products contain them and which products don't, in the sense in the market, because we tested only a relatively small fraction of what is out there. So as Graham said, I think it's really important to put label correctly this product, so you as a consumer can make an informed choice and decide, do I want to buy this product that potentially contains PFAS or not? And so it's really important that the industry start labeling these compounds and be straightforward about what's in there.
And I don't know if this would be in your field or not, but are there any laws or things about these items needing to be labeled?
That's a broad question. There are laws from 1934 and from 1966, I think, two laws that say that the cosmetics industry should label what's in them. But there are loopholes as you look on the back of these things. And the chemistry is complex. There's a polyethylene glycol, but there's also a fluorinated form of polyethylene glycol. And if you see PEG on the back of your cosmetics, it's just called PEG, because they don't want to use a lot of words. Is it the fluorinated one or not? And here's a more insidious one. There's a natural product called mica that contains fluorine, no less. And that's perfectly, it's a mineral, can't be that bad in foundation, right? It gives the luster to some of these cosmetics. But then there's a synthetic mica, which sounds like the same thing, except that they've used PFAS to make it last longer. And so it is a natural product called synthetic mica that is sometimes labeled. We did see that in a couple times on the label. But that's only some of the time, 5% of the time that we actually saw fluorine in the product. So there's a confusion on the label that just needs to be cleared up. And the way I'm going to suggest is that we just put the label, no intentional PFAS used or added. And that would be very clear. And then, of course, they'd have to check with their suppliers that they didn't indeed use it. Some of the companies were caught flat-footed by this as well. They didn't know they were using it in some cases.
Well, and that seems reasonable to have some labeling, because I'm just thinking the average consumer like myself, I wouldn't know the difference between mica or synthetic mica, even if they had it labeled on there.
And besides, you can't even read the labels most of the times. So something like, no BPA, we're all familiar when you buy water bottles, they clearly say no phthalates, no BPA, something like that is clear upfront and obvious without having to bring a magnifying glass to the store to buy cosmetics. That would be the ideal.
And have you received any pushback from the study, or are most companies that have seen that you've reviewed their stuff on board?
That's a very interesting question, and it has. We have not received any pushback. The industry is a very large industry. We've done this with the food packaging industry, which is not as big, and we didn't receive pushback. They actually saw it as an opportunity. They see it as a market advantage to be the first ones to say they had PFAS-free packaging. The same thing could apply here. We've been approached quietly by a couple of companies, the smaller ecologically friendly ones and things like that, that said, we don't think we have it, but could you test or could you tell us how we find out? And we've suggested that to a couple of small independent companies. There's one large company that has said that it was going to go PFAS-free a couple of years ago, but they were amongst the brands we tested that weren't. And that was in Europe. They announced it, not necessarily the U.S. So I think that the large companies are going to take a while to turn the corner, but they certainly are aware of our study. And there is some legislation that was introduced in the House and the Senate of the U.S. based on the study. It passed in the House, but it's stuck in committee in the Senate, and I suspect the industry will pay very dearly to keep it there. So I don't think that there's going to be regulation in our lifetime. This is the U.S. We don't tend to regulate chemicals. But I think market pressure will actually bring this to bear that, if the consumers ask for something not to be there, then the companies would see an advantage to providing that. And I'm guessing that's what they're trying to do right now, in which case that we're just the bearer of the news. You don't shoot the messenger. Anybody can measure these things and see it now that we've published it. We've published the methods by which MARTA used to determine these things, and people can reproduce that.
Mm-hmm. And MARTA, when it comes to sort of these regulations, I'm curious. So you did the cosmetics in the USA. Is there any plans to do the same thing for cosmetics in other countries?
We actually did both. We did cosmetics from North America, so it was USA, but also Canada. We tried to pick the same product across the border to see if there was any regional difference, but our sample size, we didn't have a lot of samples, so we can't comment on any differences. And also, you wouldn't think that the market for larger brands would be significantly different across the border. So we think that we covered both US and Canada. But I don't know about Graham, but I don't think there's any specific plans right now to expand to Europe or other continents, so to speak.
I'll just add to that. There was a study done 3 years ago in Europe, and they had measured in Europe, labeling is very much more required and legislated. And so they did a study on everything that listed PFAS on the label, and they saw what they expected to see, which was those ones who were labeled had PFAS in them. They left out two important categories, which was the mascara and the lipsticks. And we found a lot of fluorine in those particular categories. So we would be very interested to hear if the Europeans also see that, because we don't believe that they've changed the formulation from Europe to America, but they may have. Either way, it would be very interesting to see if Europeans had done that. And I suspect they'll follow up with a study there. We don't have access to the standard Swedish cosmetics, but I'm sure that the folks in Sweden do. And reading this paper, they'll be interested in jumping on that.
Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, I'm going to ask a question that maybe other folks are thinking about right now. Is there even a safe way to make cosmetics, or to make cosmetics safe, I should say?
I think that PFAS in most cases is an unnecessary use. So as we have seen, not all the cosmetics had PFAS. So you can certainly make cosmetics without PFAS. And some of these companies were not even aware that there was PFAS in their products because they buy finished formulations, and they don't necessarily test them. So they didn't even know that their products contain PFAS. So we think that you can create products that are PFAS-free, and also companies can check in-house and make sure that the formulations that they buy from external companies are PFAS-free.
And Graham, what's the future of this study? What are you planning to do next?
There's a lifetime of studies to be done of the same nature. We use PFAS widely, and we are working with industries primarily to cut down their use by identifying where they came from. And we've worked with textile industries, packaging industries I talked about. We're also working with carpet industries and a bunch of also consumers. The consumers are aware of these things. And as they show up, the consumers help the companies make the right decision. And so we are interested in, next, we're looking at polymer processing aids, things that are going into turf grass, synthetic turf grass, all sorts of areas where we think that these things may come into. So we'll continue to work on what we observe, and then we report it and see if we can help influence the decision makers.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us. Marta Venier, Assistant Professor at the O'Neill School of Public Environmental Affairs, and Graham Peasley, Professor of Experimental Nuclear Physics at the University of Notre Dame. Coming up, how does the Great Resignation affect the future of work? More companies are using incentives to attract employees, but is it too good to be true? If you have any questions or comments for the show today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You could also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Chances are by now that you've heard the term the Great Resignation. There are so many people quitting jobs and lots of companies looking for people to employ. But what's going on? Is it really that simple? Here with us now is Stephen Courtwright, the Henry B. Tippey Professor of Management and Director of Executive Education at the Tippey School of Business at the University of Iowa. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Thank you for having me.
So what we're seeing happening around us with employers, and in some cases, practically they are begging for people to come to work with various incentives. Is this the new normal?
You know, it's hard to say if this is the new normal or not. It's certainly the normal right now. How long it lasts is really dependent upon a whole variety of factors that are kind of causing this, this new phenomenon that we're seeing right now. There's a whole host of economic, social, and psychological factors at work right now. How long those last? Still up in the air right now, but certainly there's a lot of confluence of factors influencing what you just said.
And then, when we're looking at this surge of employment, have we ever seen this in our history where it's just like it seems everywhere you go, there's help wanted or now hiring, and it's in various levels of employment?
You know, it's interesting that you ask that, because one of the things that the Bureau of Labor Statistics is finding is that they've started keeping data of quit rates, for example, since 2000, and so only for about 21 years. And in fact, this is the largest number of people quitting their jobs since that data began to be collected. Now, simultaneously, our unemployment rate has dropped down the most recent numbers to about 5.9%, roughly. And so we see that the unemployment rate is going down, but simultaneously quit rates are going up almost in tandem with unemployment rate going down. So to answer your question, the rate of quitting is higher since we've been collecting that data, since the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been collecting that data. I can't speak for that beforehand, but certainly it is suggested in the most recent history, yeah, there has not been a time like this.
Well, when we look around us, there's so many different theories on what's causing what's happening now. But if we look at the basics, what is going on? Is it directly a result of the pandemic and people having time to reflect on what they really want to do with their lives, or is it something else?
You know, this is one of these situations where it's not one single theory that would suggest exactly what's happening. Rather, it's kind of this big confluence of different factors. So let's start with what you mentioned there. On the psychological end, there's been a couple of things at play here. So one of those, as you said, is that the pandemic, it seems, has caused people to step back and not only assess kind of the fulfillment of their jobs currently, but really the role of work to their identities and their and in context of their other pursuits in life more generally. And so this is causing some people, I think, to go and look for other opportunities, whether that's in other companies, whether that's entrepreneurial activities, certainly that's playing a role in it. But there's also other factors at play in this too. there's been a lot of different surveys suggesting that job burnout is at its highest levels. And we've know from a lot of prior research that job burnout is one of the leading predictors of turnover. There's social forces at play here. For example, remote and flexible work is something introduced specifically by the pandemic for the majority of people, whereas it was for the minority of people prior to the pandemic. Do people want to go back to the office? Some people say, no, I enjoy this remote work. Some people say, my company's going remote and I want to go back in person. And so there's always the remote and flexible work playing a role here. There's childcare issues being introduced because of the pandemic, as well as safety and social concerns. And so those are kind of social forces at play here. And then there's simply just the economic forces right now. People may have been considering leaving their jobs before the pandemic, but we know from research that when times become uncertain, people become more conservative in their decision making. And so they are more likely to stay, which is why quit rates just plummeted during the worst of the pandemic. And now we're seeing them rise to higher levels than before. And so there's maybe less uncertainty right now than there was even 18 months ago in the labor markets. That's certainly causing some people to maybe take greater risks and look for other opportunities. So there's not a single thing happening here. Rather, what makes this so unique is that they all seem to be happening at once, these economic, social, and psychological forces. And hence, probably the reason why we're seeing quit rates at such great levels right now.
That's interesting. You mentioned during uncertain times, people are more conservative and less likely to quit, I guess, because you don't know if there's going to be another job around the corner. And now it just seems like there's just jobs everywhere. And again, maybe I'm speaking for certain types of jobs. There are also folks who still can't find employment. So it's kind of, I guess, an in-between.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned there that one of the things too is we're seeing a lot of variety, a lot of variance across industries. So if you look in the Bureau of Labor Statistics data, it's very clear that the industry is facing the most turbulence right now in terms of quit rates would be the food service industry and hospitality and tourism. Every industry is experiencing this to some extent, but some industries are being affected more by the Great Resignation more than others. But even across industries, what we do see happening in general is just the power dynamics in labor markets have just shifted. Prior to the pandemic, the power was really on the employer side. And so you had more applications than there were jobs available. But all of this is all of the pandemic and all the things that I mentioned before has caused this shift in power dynamics in the market where now employees have more power in that market to be able to both choose jobs and to be choosy, which is why companies are giving more signing bonuses and are doing bringing other incentives to bring new employees in.
Yeah, I mean, I've noticed some of the big box stores were offering free tuition if you worked there. And I wonder, is that even is it a useful incentive or is that just to pull people back into a minimum wage job?
That's a really great question. And I don't know that we have the data yet on those kinds of perks, if you will, that companies offer in terms of whether they're really effective or not, at least in the long term. One thing we know from incentives is that they can be powerful inducements of human behavior, but that's not all there is to it either. And I'll just give you one example that kind of goes outside just tuition subsidies, for example, but just goes to a basic incentive, which is a raise in pay. We find that raising pay, for example, for employees generally leads to better retention, especially for your high performers. Pay raises are extremely important incentive to show, communicate value in your top performers. But the Gallup organization has some really fascinating research, and they have found that for many employees, if not most of the employees, it would take well over a 20% raise for them to leave a job where they have a manager who really engages them. And yet, if they have a manager who fails to engage them, it takes almost nothing to pull that employee away. And so do perks and do various incentives, monetary or subsidies, as you mentioned, do they work? Yes, to some degree they do work, but there's a lot of other factors at play, especially how the manager behaves towards his or her employees.
So managers listening, be good to your employees and they'll stay around.
You know, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one of the implications of it. But there's another implication of this too, by the way. And that is that as employers see more employees resign, there's oftentimes a tendency on the part of the employers to kind of write off these employees, right? They've left us, they're disloyal, or we're so focused on filling that position or filling whatever other holes we have in the organization. We don't necessarily pay attention to those turning over. But we know from a lot of research that we call them boomerang employees, that there are employees who will go back to their organizations. Well, what determines if they go back to their organizations? Oftentimes it's how they're treated when they put in their resignation. And so part of the what's on the part of employers right now in the current dynamics of the market, where again the power is shifted more toward employees, is be good to your employees who decide to leave, because you don't know if they're going to come back. And the taste that they have in their mouth when they leave the organization may very well determine whether one day they will go back or whether they'll encourage others in their networks to join your organization.
Right, right. Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Stephen Courtwright, the Henry B. Tippey Professor of Management and Director of Executive Education at the Tippey School of Business at the University of Iowa. And we're talking about the Great Resignation. So, Stephen, there are folks on two different sides of this. I don't know if it's a debate necessarily, but you'll hear that minimum wage employees have quit their jobs because they realized it wasn't worth it and went to find something that paid better or was remote. The other side is that people don't feel safe in minimum wage jobs because they have to deal with people day in and day out in the midst of a pandemic. And then there's the possibility people may have gotten really sick or have to care for sick family members. What are you seeing in this possibility of why there's a lack of employees?
In essence, we're seeing every single thing that you mentioned just right there. We're seeing that people, especially again in minimum wage jobs, and I mentioned earlier about the industries that seem to be affected more by the Great Resignation than others, and that's hospitality and tourism and food service. Generally speaking, two things that those kinds of industries have in common, at least the jobs in those industries have in common, is one, heavy customer interfacing, and two, more what economists oftentimes call lower skill or minimum wage jobs. And that's where we're seeing the most turbulence. Now, there's other factors at play there too. Hospitality and tourism took a very large financial hit during the beginning of the pandemic. And so some people left that industry and may say, I don't really want to go back to that industry. So certainly that's at play too. But in essence, there's a whole lot of factors at play for minimum wage workers. There's a whole lot of factors at play for non-minimum wage workers, for salaried workers, for high professional workers. And really, it still boils down to those economic forces, social forces, and psychological forces that are just kind of unleashing at one single point in time.
Is there any truth to, there's another argument that people aren't coming back to work because they're getting unemployment or they got some COVID subsidies?
And that argument, I know I've seen that argument a lot too. And while I certainly think it's a viable hypothesis, as well as the others, we simply just don't have the data right now to suggest that that's the case. And so right now, it could be just one of those several factors that are playing a role in addition to all the other things that we've mentioned too. We just don't have necessarily confirmation of that hypothesis given the data right now.
Well, I was recently at a mall here in Indiana, and I noticed one of the stores was closed, and it had a sign saying they're closed for 2 weeks due to staffing issues. And I found it kind of mind-boggling because there's so many people out and about shopping, but there aren't people working in these stores. And I guess I'm just trying to figure out, like, what is causing such a shortage? I know we've talked about it during this segment, but is there any other thing that we're overlooking?
You know, that is, I think, the most puzzling thing right there of what's going on right now is that consumer demand, if anything, has increased, but the ability to be able to meet that consumer demand has decreased. And so certainly, I think that what we can definitely conclude for sure is that consumer demand is not having an effect on whether people enter or exit the market right now. And so it's clearly due to other factors at play. And so, again, there may be, in of all those different things, there may just be that people are still looking for other jobs that provide more meaning and balance, that are, they're feeling burned out. And so that's led to their turnover. It could be that there are remote flexible work or childcare issues, safety concerns. It could be that there's a, they were thinking about resigning and now this is a pent up resignation, so to speak. The other thing that's at play here too, that we haven't really mentioned, but as part of the, as we mentioned, the power dynamic shifting in labor markets, is simply that this has a domino effect. And so as employers are now having to play to the power shift by increasing their the incentives to come work for them, now other people who are originally staying at their jobs are saying, hey, maybe if I do shop around somewhere for another job, I might be able to get better pay and benefits than what I'm getting right now. And so that's having this other effect on what's happening there. The question is, will this last forever? Generally speaking, and the whole notion of kind of economics in this way, and I'm not an economist, but did study economics to a certain extent, is that generally speaking, there reaches a point when we reach an equilibrium. The question is how long that's going to be. But I would just say, to add one more thing onto the plate there, is that there's a domino effect happening right now, and that will continue some time until we hit that equilibrium.
So now's the time to start shopping around, is what you're saying.
I mean, it really is. I mean, in some ways, you know, the power dynamic being shifted to the employee at this point, labor market, makes it so that if you're not at least searching around for other options, there's maybe just a couple of things that are keeping you there. And maybe that's a good way to kind of take this discussion, because there is research on what keeps people in their jobs. Sometimes it's dedication and loyalty to a particular person, for example, a boss. We know from research that people are much more committed to bosses than their organizations or a particular industry. That's, again, what the Gallup research and other research would suggest. Sometimes people are glued to a particular area and they may not see that there's jobs for what they do in their particular area. There's a lot of other reasons why people stay embedded in their jobs. But it is in the employee's interest right now to look for other opportunities, because now time is of the essence, if you will, of the ability to be able to choose from a variety of options and to increase anything from pay and benefits to an opportunity to do work that maybe you feel more suited for or feel more passionate about. So in essence, yeah, it is kind of incumbent, if you will, on employees to do this, understanding that there's other factors at play that keep people embedded in their jobs too.
Well, we have about a minute and a half left. I'm wondering if any of this is a positive thing, where it's forcing employers and companies to shift the way they do things.
I absolutely see it that way, as a positive. And I think that anytime the power dynamics shift, there's basically different responsibilities, if you will, or tasks on each different party. Oftentimes when it comes to, when the power shifts to employers, then the responsibility for kind of retooling, if you will, or for qualifying, for increasing qualifications, falls on the employee side. But now it's kind of shifted. And so now employers are having to really kind of reassess how it is that they attract workers. And by and large, at least for employees, that is a good thing. And there's good things that come from it. There's also headaches that come from it. We may very well see, for example, that there's no such thing as a free lunch. So increase in wages, that may pass on to consumers. And so from an economic perspective, there may be some disadvantages. But certainly for individual employees, this is a remarkably good time for them. And we'll see some good things come from it in terms of various things, from pay to benefits to other things that are important to employees.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. It's been such an insightful discussion. Stephen Courtwright is the Henry B. Tippey Professor of Management and Director of Executive Education at the Tippey School of Business at the University of Iowa. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you want to listen to a previous episode of this program or to this one right now, you can get it anywhere you find your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In.